Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm just in.
Good morning. Welcome to Mornings with Carmen LaBurge. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. There you go. It is Valentine's Day 2019. We're going to talk about love today, and we're going to talk about the love of God as it is brought to bear in the world that he so loves. It is 1 year ago today that a desperate, suicidal, mentally ill young man entered his former high school in Parkland, Florida. 17 people ultimately died as a result of his actions. I said at the time that there was a Valentine's card that nobody published, and it would be Jeremiah 17, verse 9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? That is not a Valentine's Day card you're going to see today. But the truth is, had anyone taken the time and brought the resources of the church and the community to bear on the deceitful, desperately wicked, broken heart of one young man, we would be having a different conversation today. But we have to be perfectly honest. We would still be having a conversation about a culture where people do evil all day long. He just happened to do the kind of evil that we can all recognize. So I hope that your heart continues to be broken as mine does for these families, for the teachers, for the school district, for the first responders, the justice system, which now has to process this young man. His brother, whose story is quite remarkable, if you are not attuned into that particular headline of the day. The list of concerns is very long. And somewhere in all of that, there's a conversation about family systems, the mental health of our children and young adults, the capacity of our school system to deal with all those complications. And what happens when a kid ages out of all of our government programs? Add to that the conversation about access to guns, gun control, and the politics of the day, which seem to capitalize on this kind of pain. And ultimately, we have a conversation about education and mental health and health care. And frankly, the role of every citizen in the community to pay attention and to actually take action, to take responsibility for this thing we call community and the common good. So this is a conversation about saying something when we see something, and not just saying something to the authorities, but actually saying something to the person whose behavior is raising alarms. So why are we so quick to say something about someone and yet so slow to cross the street and intervene? Now, I recognize that that is inconvenient, may seem like dangerous counsel, but the alternative to intervention is a Valentine's Day that nobody ever wanted. People saw a troubled, isolated young man. People recognized a kid in crisis. People knew he did not experience success in the educational system. People knew he was socially disconnected. People knew he was grieving the loss of his adopted mom. People knew he felt like he was totally alone in the world. And whose job was it to intervene? Was it the school's job or law enforcement or family or mental health providers or disability support programs? Everyone had an opportunity. But who did the John 3:16 intervention? So that's going to be my call and challenge to us as members of the body of Christ, the church today in the world. All right, friends, up next, my conversation with Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute. He and I are going to talk about Valentine's Day and what love has to do with economics and public policy. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge.
This is my right. Right, given by God, to live a free life, to live in
free. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, joined now by Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute. Ben, welcome back. It is Valentine's Day, so I'd love to start with this. What does love have to do with economics and public policy?
Well, good morning, and here are some virtual flowers across our listening audience here. All the way from Ohio. Wonderful to be with you as always, particularly on Valentine's Day.
Okay, so I had a total Valentine's flower fail. Today is my mom's anniversary, in addition to being Valentine's Day, so I sent her flowers. And so I called last night to, you know, because I knew they'd arrive because you get that little alert on your phone. And so I'm so excited. And I'm just like practically patting myself on the back through the phone. And she's like, "Well, honey, it's beautiful. I hope they bloom by Mother's Day. It's like a garden, Ben. It's like a dirt thing. She has to like plant it in the container and hope for flowers by Mother's Day." So there you go. So I will receive your virtual flowers.
Thank you. And it hadn't occurred to me. Does she live someplace where she could plant them?
Yeah, well, she's in Tucson, Arizona. So, yeah, she's good to go. Yeah, she's good to go.
Okay, well, thank goodness. Yeah. So, that's an example of love and economics coming together. People spending money on people that they love. And people this year are actually going to spend more than ever before. The average person is going to spend $162 on Valentine's Day this year, according to the National Retail Federation. That's a lot of flowers, a lot of candy. Now, economics always seems mystifying with demand curves and 10-year forecasts of interest rates and things of that sort. But really, there's a simple way to think of it. Economics is human action. If you show me what someone spends, I'll show you what he values. And that's really what it's about. Jesus said, "Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." And so when people treasure certain things, they will inevitably follow up in terms of writing a check or supporting that. And we agree as Christians, some things should never be available for purchase, like a human being. You and I would agree that an abortion should never be available for purchase. It's simply immoral and wrong. And that's where politics comes in. Politics says that together we agree that human dignity needs to be respected in such a way that certain behavior needs to be beyond commodification. And so economics is the concrete nuts and bolts way we provide for people who mean the very most to us. It brings people together in free choice relationships that let us cooperate. Politics is the parameter that's set around that. The problem is when that parameter begins to squeeze a little too much, politics ultimately will divide us if it starts overstepping its boundaries and doing things that politicians were not intended to do, or if we don't have an underlying cultural agreement of what's really important in the first place, what government should be doing in terms of first principles. So we smile when we leave the coffee shop each morning. We grit our teeth when political ads start airing.
Mm. So it occurred to me as you were talking in terms of like where we spend our money, there's a who answer to that question. And at the intersection of maybe those two conversations is the times in which the government actually compels people to spend their money on something or someone they should love, but for whatever reason, they aren't doing that. I'm thinking here of like child support. It's always been a mystery to me why people don't just willingly financially support the children who they brought into this world. But sometimes child support has to be compelled by the government. And that's sort of the intersection of economics, public policy, and this idea that economics is sort of the financial love grease of people.
Well, precisely. If you look at that errant father's checkbook, it will tell you that what he cares about is himself or some other diversion, perhaps alcohol or something else, but not necessarily about his own children in terms of supporting them in a concrete way. So it's amazing that sometimes as culture begins to break down, the state has to step in and force people to do things that should come naturally. Like you say, loving your own flesh should be the most natural thing that ever comes to any one of us. Even pagans, Jesus says, did this. You know, even the heathens know to give gifts to their children, and yet we're not even giving support in this country. So, as culture breaks down, ultimately government has to step in. That's why there's such a tie in terms of preserving strong families, strong culture, strong values. Government ultimately will always rush in to fill the vacuum where moral behavior begins to drop off. So it's vital, if you believe in limited government, that can only exist, as John Adams said, among a religious and a moral people.
That I think is the sticking point today on this Valentine's Day. I think that when we talk about a desire to be a people who are personally responsible and to be a people who take care of the concerns that are in front of us, to be good stewards over all the resources, you know, that God has placed under our management as his agents of grace in this world. I think right there you've put your finger on the pulse and the heartbeat of the challenges we face as Christians in the culture today.
Well, and no one wants to hear now you have additional responsibilities, right? Everyone wishes to shun those responsibilities. I'll tell you about one poll that's somewhat heartbreaking. There was a study done, and this is the year 2000 when it came out, I believe, but it's almost a generation old at this point. they did a survey of young people, and they asked, at what point do you believe that people should be mature enough to make decisions about their own life, like whether they drink or whether they smoke, whether they have sex, things of that sort. They said the average age should be 13. They asked, at what age should the average person be responsible for himself in the terms that he's paying all of his own bills, he's out of his parents' home, he's self-reliant? They said 30. So if you want to know what's wrong with America, it's an 18-year adolescence. You know, we've taken something that's intended to run 6 or 7 years and tripled it. So and our culture embraces that wholeheartedly. So what we need is maturity, and ultimately we need people to stop adulting and become adults.
All right, Ben, how about you and I take a moment aside, and when we come back, let's talk about this Panera experiment that that has not worked. Friends, you are listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBerge, continuing my conversation with Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute. Ben, Panera tried something called Panera Cares. They were literally feeding anyone at all hours of the day when they were open for free. Tell us how that worked out and what they learned.
I would imagine that it would work out. There's this saying, there's no such thing as a free lunch. They tried. To be fair, what they tried to do, they opened up five different locations in five fairly economically depressed areas, and they said that people could pay anything that they wanted to. They had the price on the menu, but they said it was a suggested price. You could pay more, you could pay less, you could pay nothing. If you could pay nothing, then you would volunteer for an hour in the store, maybe cleaning it up a little bit, and you would get your meal for free. Ultimately, the way that it worked out is they're about to close their last location in Boston tomorrow, because they hemorrhaged money everywhere. As it turned out, people took advantage of this. They when they forecast this, the founder of Panera, Ron Shaich, said that they would have about as many people paying more as who paid less. A lot of people would like to pick up the tab for other people. As it turns out, they said that Panera is a wealthy corporation. It's got billions of dollars, or millions at any rate, and so we are more than capable of letting them pick up the bill. And so they never recouped anything close to the money that they put into it. As it turned out, high school students went there every day for lunch. Homeless people ate there three times a day for free each time. And no one decided to pick up the bill for the rest of it. At one point, again, the founder actually kind of screamed out on PBS, "Don't you understand? Somebody's got to pay the bill." So ultimately, what they're going to do is go back to their old model, where Panera focuses on making money, and then it gives the excess profits to other people, you know, to food banks across the country. That's the right way of handling this. To say that lunch is available for free for whatever you want to pay for it, ultimately, that's never going to work, because you can't repeal the laws of economics. And as you were talking about our darkened heart, you know, Jesus Christ said, out of the heart come adulteries and every form of wickedness. The fact of the matter is that gluttony and sloth are two of those. And so if people have an opportunity to game the system, even if they're not really poor, they will take that. And ultimately, they will do that until the company goes bankrupt.
So, Ben, income inequality, food insecurity, these are realities in America. Talk with us about how you see those issues and challenges being rightly addressed.
Yeah, well, you know, the most important thing that we can do as the church is be the church. And the church is called to be our brother's keeper. It's called to care for the least of these. It is called to do so many of the things that have been taken over by governments at all levels, state, national, local. In fact, these should be done by the church. But there is economic inequality. There was a study that came out just recently that your listeners may have heard of from Gabriel Zucman. It said that the top 1% owns as much as 40% of the total household wealth. Top 1% owns 40%, and the bottom half owns almost nothing. The problem with that study is actually the way wealth is defined. He uses kind of a wonky way of doing it. I'm actually somewhat somewhat sanguine about our current prospects. What's really important isn't so much equality or inequality. What's important is what direction we're all going. The average American is making more money now than we were making before the Great Recession started in 2007. We finally crossed that threshold. So the good news is that everyone is doing better. And that's really the metric that we need to measure. And in order for that to happen, we need to have relative economic freedom. We need to have policies that understand that job creation is a good thing, not a negative thing. Ultimately, should be rewarded, taxed only as much as we need to. And the government should allow the economy to take care of creating the wealth. And the church is ultimately what needs to step forward. You know, this past week, we crossed a threshold. The United States is now $22 trillion in debt for the first time. Donald Trump's asked agencies to cut their budget by about 5%. That's literally nickel and diming a trillion-dollar problem. We have $1 trillion added to that every year. The bottom line is there's no explicit constitutional authorization for most of the programs that federal government is undertaking. The church needs to step up, be our brother's keeper, and increase the acts of mercy that Jesus Christ calls us to. So when those government programs ultimately run out of money and they falter or they begin rationing and they're not providing them to everyone, Christians will be able to stand in the gap and minister to our fellow brothers and sisters.
Ben, when we talk about that debt, and it is enormous, it's sort of beyond our ability to even imagine as regular people. What is this kind of debt, or who does this kind of debt hurt, and near term and long term?
Yeah, well, near term, you can always hit the snooze alarm a little bit, except that the real problem in the short term is that we have interest payments. Interest payments, we're talking in the neighborhood of $7 trillion minimum over the next 10 years. So that's massive. And so you're talking about an additional $7 trillion in interest costs over 10 years that wouldn't exist otherwise. So where we're $1 trillion in debt every year, that's essentially a large percentage of the deficit that we're looking at simply to go to pay the national interest. Very soon, the interest on the national debt will be our largest expenditure, larger than Social Security, Medicare, other areas of the federal government if we don't rein in spending. This has been a bipartisan problem. Both parties have been guilty of this. Long term, the issues are sort of twofold. One of them is that a large federal deficit always drags the economy down, increases interest rates. You have the threat of inflation and simply monetizing the debt, in which case it punishes people who saved and did well, did the right thing, and it rewards people who are profligate in their spending. And really long term, if you combine this issue of a large federal deficit with a huge federal spending program, the real issue isn't so much the amount of the debt as it is the percentage compared to our overall economy. We have a strong economy and we keep growing. If for some reason the economy were to slow down, say that we had a socialist policy or we had a huge government spending program that radically changed a certain sector of our economy and shut it down, then that would create, has the potential to trigger a debt crisis in the United States. And at that point, you're looking at something like potentially Venezuela.
Well, you're just full of bright, cheery news today, Ben.
I bring you love on Valentine's Day.
Well, and I think that the truth of the matter is that sometimes the loving thing to say is also the difficult thing. It's also it's a narrative of responsibility. It is a wake up call. And so we appreciate the clarity with which you you bring love to bear on these conversations. It's not loving to just let someone continue to wander down a path that we all know leads to not only personal travail, but communal travail. And so I think that Christians raising concerns about our national debt and the church stepping in to provide for the least of these among us in ways that don't just meet the physical need, but begin to really target and challenge the spiritual needs that are at the root of really all of these conversations.
You're right. When we're talking about responsibility, people love to ask politicians to be responsible, at least in the aggregate. We understand at a certain level that a $1 trillion deficit is a moral failure on some level, that people have failed in planning or they failed in terms of what government should be doing and should not be doing. But there's some sort of massive problem. But the fact of the matter is, in a democratic government like this, ultimately that reflects our priorities and what we're telling politicians to do at some, in some instance. If there's an issue, it's an issue of oversight. And quite often, the greatest force in the spiritual life is the Holy Spirit. The second greatest is self-deception. And you know, we need to have an accountability partner who can hold a mirror up to us, show us our blind spots, show us where we need the Holy Spirit to change and reform our lives. And when individuals are healed, when the Holy Spirit begins to spread across this land, when there's revival, which I desperately think that we need and we should pray for day in and day out, and people are sanctified and changed from the inside out, then government will change from the inside out as well.
Ben, thank you so much. Very insightful and encouraging, really. That's a great walk-off. All right, Ben and I are going to leave it right there, and let's lighten it up here for just a moment. And when we come back, I'm going to tell you about a really cool Bible giveaway that we're doing here on Faith Radio. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBerge, and you are listening to Mornings with Carmen. You can enrich your daily study of God's Word by utilizing something called Truth for Life Spurgeon Study Bible. We're actually giving away two Spurgeon Study Bibles every week this month, and so we want you to enter to win. You can enter at myfaithradio.com. You would have the opportunity to use the sermon notes and illustrations from a great preacher, Charles Spurgeon, in the Truth for Life Spurgeon Study Bible. So go to myfaithradio.com and sign up to win one of the copies we're giving away this week. I'm Carmen LaBerge on Mornings with Carmen. When I come back, I'm going to be having a conversation with Diane Langberg. We are going to address the Houston Chronicle Abuse of Faith series of articles.
Common Core? Parents and objective-minded teachers are making waves. This is Jim Garlow. When Common Core standards were put into place, states were forced to comply with core standards, even though 37 states had higher standards already for English and 39 states had higher standards for math. The new standards encourage teachers to teach to a test, not to a student. What's exciting is that parents and teachers are fighting back. Both are realizing the so-called standards should be rejected, not just accepted as is. The result? Many states have rejected Common Core altogether. It's a great example of parents and teachers standing together for their kids' education. We have no greater challenge or responsibility than to do as Proverbs 22:6 says, train up a child in the way they should go. It comes with a promise. When he's old, he will not depart from it. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Surely my God is strength of my soul.
Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge, and I am joined now by Dr. Diane Langberg. For those of you who are not familiar with her work, she's a practicing psychologist. She's an international speaker. She works with trauma survivors, specifically survivors of sexual abuse, their caregivers, and clergy around the world. Diane, welcome to Mornings with Carmen.
Thank you very much.
It's a privilege to be talking with you today. I think that as each and every one of us intersects with the headline news related to sexual abuse that takes place in the life of the church, we find ourselves horrified and paralyzed in many cases. And so I'm hoping that today you can help mobilize us. You can get us beyond our paralysis. You can help us know how to invite the stories of survivors, how to be the kind of people that people would tell, and then, you know, really equip us to know what we can do from there. So I'm just going to give you the floor and let you equip us.
Okay. Let me start with a sort of a broader statement, which I believe with all my heart, and that is that I believe that the voices of victims in the church, not just in terms of these recent reports, but certainly in this nation and around the world as well, is actually the voice of God to his church. Mm. He is calling us to turn on the lights. He's calling us to see what we have avoided seeing and to banish the dark corners where things have been allowed to happen. Many years ago, a part of my family worked in the coal mines, and it was, I'm sure many know the story, often very toxic down there, and they would take canaries in cages down into the mines. And when the canaries stopped singing, they knew it was toxic, and they got out. The voices of victims are the canaries, and they are not singing. And so, yes, what's been in the Houston Chronicle is overwhelming. It is the tip of the iceberg. I've done this work for 46 years. It's been going on forever. And God is saying it's time. So that means what you just said, we need to prepare ourselves so that we do this well. And we are not ready. The church is not ready to deal with the victims. So that's the first thing we need to know. That we don't understand, we don't really know what it's like to be a victim, and even if someone is a victim, their story is different. So we cannot assume, that's the first rule, that we know anything. And so we need to begin to do some reading about sexual abuse. I've written a book for victims on the threshold of hope. I have another one on suffering in the heart of God, how trauma destroys and Christ restores, that talks about sexual abuse and domestic violence and all kinds of things. We need to study. And the second thing we need to do is listen. We can't walk up to a victim and ask them to tell us their story. Number one, they don't trust anybody because they've not only been mistreated and abused by somebody, but they've also had that covered up when they went for help. So why would they trust us? They're wise not to. And so as we study and pray, there's probably going to be somebody we already know. We may not know much about it. We may not know how to think about it, but everybody has somebody in their lives who's been abused. I mean, the stats that we have are 1 in 4 females, 1 in 6 males in the United States are sexually abused before the age of 18, and the statistics are no different in the church. For all we know, they're higher. I don't know. So I do a lot of cross-cultural work, and the main thing I do when I go is listen. I have to understand what it's like to be you. What's it like to live in your skin? What's it like to carry memories like that? What's it like not to sleep? What's it like not to be able to shut the memories up? What's it like to be afraid all the time? And so we need to listen in a way that is like Jesus, who became like us. He put on our skin. We have to put on the skin of victims and listen with humility and grieve with them, lament. Lament not only what happened to them, but lament over the condition of God's people, that they did not listen and that they have covered up this atrocious sin. And as we listen and study and grieve and lament with them, the time for comfort will come. We want to rush in and give them a verse and tell them to feel better in the morning. Mostly we do that for ourselves. That's not how this works. People heal little by little. That's true in the physical realm. If I fall down on the ice and break my leg, it's going to take months for that leg to heal. It's going to hurt while it heals, and I'm going to be annoyed that it takes so long. I have a talk that I've done around the world on this where I say 3 things are necessary for healing: talking, tears, and time. And time we have no control over. And the talking doesn't mean just telling the story once. It means saying it bit by bit and testing the water. And then it means saying it again because you really didn't fully explain it because you didn't really know how to do it out loud anymore. And the tears come in many, many ways. But then it takes time. So the question also is whether or not we're willing to continue on the long, hard journey to find healing for things who, for many people, were done when they were small children and while they were being shaped. You know, we protect our children in terms of what we feed them at the dinner table because we know it affects their bodies when they're in their 50s and 60s and 70s. Well, the same thing is true with these kinds of things. They have been fed toxins, and nobody has come with treatment, and it has shaped who they are, how they see themselves, how they see God, everything. And so it's a slow, long walk. What I would also like to say is that that walk, that study, that listening, that entering in, and that slow walk will change both people. If we respond to this the way God calls us to, it will transform the church because we will be more like Christ.
If you've just joined us, I'm Carmen LaBurge, and my conversation during this half hour is with Dr. Diane Langberg. She is a trauma therapist. I'm going to encourage everyone who's listening right now to read her blog at dianelangberg.com. It is recommendations for churches dealing with abuse. It's easy to find. The books that she has referenced, On the Threshold of Hope and Suffering in the Heart of God, you can also find through her website, again, dianelangberg.com. Diane and I are going to continue this conversation in just a minute. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I am your host, Carmen LaBurge, continuing my conversation with Dr. Diane Langberg. Please check out her website, dianelangberg.com. Diane, let's move a little bit, if we can, into what we can do. We've acknowledged that the church is as susceptible to these issues and this chronic scourge as any other institution or reality, and yet we seem somewhat paralyzed right now to adequately respond. So will you walk us through some things that, as the church, we need to do?
Yes. I first want to say that in some ways we should be paralyzed. We should be stunned. And if we're not, and haven't worked with this for a long time, we're not paying attention. So I think that's number one. Two, I think the underlying thing here has to be humility, because we don't know what to do. And so we need a lot of, again, study and things like that, not just for dealing with individuals, but also for how the church can respond. I'm on the board for GRACE, Godly Response to Abuse in a Christian Environment, which is at netgrace.org with Boz Chavijian. And they have trainings for churches and trainings for seminaries and have put out a book on guidelines and policies and procedures for churches. And so part of what we can do as lay people is demand that our leaders study these things and get training about them so that what we set up to do is done well, not just for the sake of the victims, though certainly that, also for the sake of the abusers whom we are leaving in their bondage because we're not dealing with it, and for the sake of the body, the larger body. And so I think that lay people have a very powerful voice at this time to speak to their leaders about that. You mentioned the blog that I wrote in terms of recommendations for churches, and you know, one of those is number one, number two, and number three is this: if a minor ever discloses to you any form of abuse, sexual, emotional, verbal, whatever, the first response is to call the civil authorities. We're called to do that in the Book of Romans. We've been disobeying that. So anytime we know of a minor, whether it's your own child, the neighbor's child, a child in church, bring the authorities in. They are the ones who are trained to investigate this. They are the ones who know how to do it without poisoning the water in some way in one direction or the other. I mentioned GRACE. You know, they do independent investigations. So if somebody on staff is abusing or is alleged to have abused, you need somebody who is not invested in preserving the institution to come in and do the investigation. If it's done in-house, the investment is in making everything okay. But it isn't okay. And so it has to be done independently. And if we truly heed the word of God, that will make perfect sense to us, because he says our own hearts are so deceitful we can't even figure them out. So we're, again, honoring his word by bringing in independent investigators. And if people will go to the blog, they will see in looking for such investigators, and you should know who one is, so if the crisis comes, you're already prepared to make the call. But it will tell you things to ask when you're interviewing them to find out how they do their work, what their experience is, what their skill levels are. And I would also say to churches and to friends who walk with victims, the same kinds of questions need to be asked if you're referring somebody to a counselor or therapist. Oftentimes somebody will say, you know, I'm a Christian counselor, and so they'll send people there with trauma and abuse histories, and they've never had any training in those particular areas. So those kinds of questions need to be asked about investigators and organizations, or they also need to be asked about counselors. How long have you worked with this? Where did you get your training? Whose work has influenced you? All of those things, so that they're not practicing on somebody without being able to work with somebody who knows what to do and how to help.
So, Diane, and again, if you're just joining us, I'm Carmen LaBurge. You are listening to Mornings with Carmen. My guest is Dr. Diane Langberg. You can find her blog, Recommendations for Churches Dealing with Abuse, at dianelangberg.com. I've also tweeted it out at Carmen LaBurge if you follow me on Twitter, and we'll post it later as well on the Mornings with Carmen page on My Faith Radio. Diane, I think that one of the experiences that I have had in waves as these revelations are made publicly, and as you say, you know, we're not paying attention if we don't recognize that this has been going on and that this is a part of not just the culture, but it is a part of what's happening in the church. If we've been blind to that, then shame on us. But once survivors start talking and start telling their stories, I have seen people actually draw back from them. I have seen there's this like a whole new isolation that comes. So could you spend a minute just speaking directly to victims of sexual abuse and tell them that there are people who are willing and are listening and would lean in?
Yes, I would like to say first about your comment about people pulling back. One of the things I tell young therapists that I'm training is that our responses to these things tell us about what it's like for the victim. They want to pull back too, and they can't. So when we hear them and we want to run, or we feel overwhelmed, or we find it just, this can't be real, or whatever, those are all things that victims feel. So we need to let those things inform us. And not run away, of course. But yes, to victims, particularly in situations like that the Chronicle is reporting, you have not only been abused, you have been treated as a liar. And many, you've been tossed out on your ear, or you left because that was safer to do. And so you're afraid to tell your story. And on one level, you should be. I mean, the facts would suggest that that's a very wise thing. On the other level, if you don't tell your story and really work with a safe person, the healing is less likely to come. I'm not going to say it never comes without that help, because certainly it can sometimes. But it needs to be done in safe relationship. Trauma and abuse break your relationships. Healing needs to be based on a safe relationship. Trauma and abuse shut up your voice. Healing is based on having a safe place to speak your voice. Trauma makes you helpless. Healing needs to give you choice and power restored in a way that you can use to God's glory in this world. So if you're afraid to put your toe in the water, I get it. Look for somebody who does the kind of counseling work that is trained to do this, or a friend that you know has studied this and has cared for other victims. You have the power to choose a safe person. Mm. You need to think about that and find a way to do that It doesn't have to be somebody in the church. It can be somebody in the professional world. It can be both. But I would encourage you not to let the sin of the church keep you yet again from your own healing. It's there to be had.
Diane, thank you so much for being with us this morning and for equipping us on this very important and essential matter. Again, visit DianeLangberg.com for her blog on this. Check out her books on the threshold of hope, suffering, and the heart of God. And also check out netgrace.org in terms of training and equipping for your local congregation. This is Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. It is Valentine's Day, and here on Mornings with Carmen, I certainly want to acknowledge the love of God in Jesus Christ for each and every one of us. And you may not be feeling particularly loved today. You may not feel as if you are in love. Well, let me remind you that there is a lover of your soul who will never leave you and never forsake you. There is love from God, in God, because God is love. Now, love is not God, although today in the culture, you may be tempted to believe that love is God. Actually, God is love. And so let me encourage us today that we should love the Lord our God with all our heart and all our soul and all our strength, and we should love our neighbors as ourselves. That, if you do that today on Valentine's Day, you will have accomplished what is in the very heart of God, which is that his love would extend to more and more people. You are listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Let's listen to the news and then return to our conversation about Valentine's Day. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.